Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet a key part of the creative team for Tulsa Ballet's upcoming world premiere of Dorothy and the Prince of Oz, an original full-length ballet by choreographer Edward Liang. Our guest today is set and puppetry designer Basil Twist. Twist is a 2015 MacArthur Genius Grant recipient and is one of the foremost puppeters of his time, taking his art to completely new places in a career that spans ballet, Broadway, opera, theater, and new genres. Twist is probably best known for his Symphonie Fantastique, an abstract work performed underwater with silk puppetry, Rites of Spring, a ballet without dancers, and Dogugaishi, a puppetry involving moving screens based on ancient Japanese traditions. But his work includes puppetry for Broadway, like The Addams Family, Beauty and the Beast, and The Pee Wee Herman Show, opera, Houston Opera's Hansel and Gretel, ballet, Palabolas Dance, and collaborations with choreographer Christopher Wheeldon, including a new Nutcracker with Joffrey Ballet, which premiered 2 months ago, and in drama, works ranging from New York's Shakespeare in the Park's Hamlet to Peter and Wendy and Paula Vogel's The Long Christmas Ride Home. He'll be doing sets and puppetry for Dorothy and the Prince of Oz, which has its world premiere this Friday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Basil Twist, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I know a lot of people are looking forward to this new production of Dorothy and the Prince of Oz, and I know you've done ballets before, even ballets without dancers
at one point.
But I think one of the things that you said that attracted you to this production is the fact that it's a complete new story. There's new music. There's everything about it is completely new.
Yeah.
When you have a blank canvas like that, how do you go about creating a world, especially a world like Oz?
Well, you know, I'm not totally the author of it. Obviously, it's my fantastic collaborator, Edward Liang, who's sort of driving it and choosing. You know, there was a decision about which of the Oz books we were going to be inspired by. But then within there was wiggle room to figure it out, you know. I mean, what's thrilling also is that I'm designing the sets too. So in the other ballets I've done, I haven't had that as much input there. I'm more just doing the puppets or the effects. So here I get to do both, which means that I get to integrate that into the sets, you know, how they work together. And in my own work, I do my sets and stuff, so it makes sense.
What was the first steps in sort of creating this world?
Getting together with Edward and trying to just understand sort of what the parameters were and what also the artistic director in Tulsa Ballet, Marcello, what he was hoping for. And, you know, they wanted something pretty. Of course, they wanted something cool. They wanted something impressive. They wanted something enchanting and, you know, it's big. It's a big theater that it's in. So just figuring out the basic plot points and I'm someone who, if I do set design, I like a sense of animation to it. I would like it to be really dynamic and see stuff moving and stuff. I mean, I kind of apply my puppetry sense to the set in a way too. So just looking for opportunities and ways to do that and to have that all make sense within the story. I mean, the first thing really was there's a principal book, which is mostly Glinda of Oz, which is the last of the Oz books that Frank Baum wrote. And that's where most of the plot elements come from. So taking that and just trying to figure out how many locations, how do we get there? How do you keep that moving and rolling forward?
Now, I've seen at least some previews in which it's not Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, but Dorothy's in this. And I guess there is the Kansas scene in a tornado, right?
Yeah, there is. You know, that's, I mean, everyone has such fond memories, particularly of the film. You cannot, sure. You have to acknowledge that in our sort of collective conscious. So there is a Kansas scene. There's a storm that has her, that transports her to Oz. The Kansas is more monochromatic, and then we get to Oz, and it's very colorful. But otherwise, then it changes. You know, it's different.
Well, I've seen some of your work for this. There's this beautiful diamond swan puppet that is gorgeous. Three puppeteers working this. What about those creations, things like that? There is sort of a horse-like figure that almost looks like it's made out of a wall.
Yeah, They're actually dogs. They're just really
dogs.
Big.
Okay.
So they, I guess it was Edward's take that he wanted these. There's two kind of dueling characters. There's a king and a queen, and he kind of, particularly in knowing that I would be involved, to give me an opportunity, they would each have some sort of companion with them, some animal companion. A little like there was a film called The Golden Compass that had characters had something called a familiar, which so there was a bear or an owl. And so there is a diamond swan in the story. It actually plays a different role. But I thought that was such a cool image. Let's have a diamond swan. And then the idea of a king and that he lives in a mountain lair and that he would have these two sort of dogs at either side of him and that they would be made out of stones as well. Just seems
sort of a takeoff on like the marble lions or bronze lions that accompany any king, right?
Yeah. Except these ones are made out of stone. but they move. And I just thought that was a kind of a regal thing. I mean, both of them are very regal.
Now, does the production use puppeteers or does it use dancers operating?
No, whenever I've worked with any ballet company, and I've worked also with several dance companies, sure. And the interest is for me to bring this craft and to put it on the performers that they have. I mean, I think it's not just a question of budget and resources, because it would be a whole other thing to bring in other people and rehearse with them, but it gives their companies a range of something different that they can do. And that I've been doing that a lot, where I work with non-traditional puppeteers and I have to form them and train them, which means that I both have to create puppetry that is intuitive and hopefully pleasurable for them. And also I need to push them and form them and train them how to be puppeteers and give them a little more technique and stuff.
When they're operating the puppets, are they sort of a combination of dance and puppeteer, or are they functioning in one role or the other?
They're mostly, I start by pushing them into being a puppeteer and encouraging them to to express themselves through it, because it's actually, I try and design them so they're intuitive and you actually can. The way that, I think that anybody has it in them, the way that, you know, when we were all kids, we would play with our dolls or action figures. It's that same sort of projecting yourself into something or through something. And then I'm noticing now this week we've been trying to polish it up and I'm realizing these people are dancers. And I can ask them to have their own movements have more quality to them, that they create more beautiful lines and support the image without just being like a clump of people who are attached to this puppet.
Yeah, I would think that adds a lot of dynamics to the character that you're creating.
Yeah, and I mean, it is a choreography. Even when I work with puppeteers, it's a choreography, especially when you have all these puppets take more than one person to work them. So it's a question of teamwork. It's a question of staging so that you're on the right side of the puppet and you might have to switch places and how to do that in a way that's primary in my mind here and how I designed the puppetry is I wanted these dancers to look elegant doing it, because puppeteers sometimes will get hunched over in the most uncomfortable positions to accomplish their, you know, in the service of a certain image. And I didn't want to bring that on stage here. I want the dancers to look as gorgeous and elegant as they do without puppets in their hands.
Now, I've read where you said, in fact, one of your first breaks was working with, I believe it was a singer who didn't really want to operate a puppet in a production.
Uh-huh.
And you actually got to go on stage as a stagehand with Julie Taymor early on. And you said, you know, sometimes actors and singers don't necessarily want to do this. I would think dancers might be a little different because they're so used to being attuned with their body.
Well, I have found occasionally that sometimes dancers are so in their bodies that it's tricky for them to transmit energy through. If you put something in their hands, it sort of crosses their synapses and and they can't even walk as well. And I think there's also, you know, in the case of an actor, frequently it's a question of, honestly, of ego too. Actors are generally front and center, and so a puppeteer, as I sort of, you know, gestured with this microphone, you're retiring, you hide behind it. It's just a natural inclination. So that's why I'm, I don't know, I've been doing this enough years with non-puppeteers to sort of coax it out of them.
Now you'll have to tell us a story about your first break with Julie Taymor. You were a stagehand for her, right?
Well, I moved to New York and I actually met her within the first couple of days that I was there, completely by accident, at the Library of Performing Arts at Lincoln Center. And she had an exhibit up and I walked in and had no idea that it was up. And then she was actually there too. So it was really an amazing stroke of good luck, which I've had lots of in my career. And that eventually led to me getting involved in a show called Wandarian, which I was a stagehand. But I was, you know, I was dressed in black and all the actors were dressed in black. And there were moments where the actors who were dressed in black and had these sort of, you know, hoods over their heads and stuff, they just really weren't into it, certain parts as much. And there was a part where there was like a toucan that was supposed to fly across the stage. And at one point, this one actor just said, "Would you do it for me?" And I did it, and no one could tell who it was who was doing it. And I remember the toucan got a, you know, note like, "Oh, the toucan was really good tonight." So that was, anyway, that was an amazing experience to work with Julie. And this was before The Lion King, but she was still doing, she was doing incredible work. And, you know, as a young artist coming to New York to see an artist working in that medium in such an ambitious and original way was so inspiring.
And for Americans, I mean, for those who had grown up with a Muppet Show or, you know, Kukla and Ollie.
Which we love.
Yeah, we love. Yeah, I mean, it was a
incredible.
Totally new way of thinking of puppetry.
It was so different. Yeah, it was so different and brought in all these traditions from all over the world. And yeah, I was very lucky.
Well, I know you're going to encourage us to go to see what Oz looks like in your set design, but what were some of the things you wanted to portray in your particular Oz?
Well, I was a real Oz head as a kid. I read all of the books and had them all. I loved the drawings that were in them. I just was really, I loved the Oz world. My grandmother that I was really close to, her name was Dorothy. There was a lot of things that I connected to in the Oz books. I liked the, of course, the fantastical, the strange fantastical characters, the whimsical fantastical characters, the sense of different lands that you would visit, that they're so different, this environment. I wasn't even really aware of it as a kid, but now I really appreciate how much Oz is very female-centric. There's a real, you know, all the rulers of Oz, except for the wizard, are female. And the protagonists and the sort of the characters in the Oz books, it's unusual for that time. I don't know, I just loved that world. And I loved that this ballet was going to not just do The Wizard of Oz, which of course we all love that movie, but to kind of go back closer to the original source materials and expand on them, because there's all of these books and they're fantastic.
So you're taking little moments from several?
It's a little bit of a collage.
It's a pastiche?
Yeah. It's a pastiche principally from two books, which would be Glinda of Oz and The Lost Prince of Oz.
Mm. Well, I know a lot of people are looking forward to seeing this. My guest today is Basil Twist, a puppeteer and set designer for Tulsa Ballet and Ballet Met's collaboration for world premiere ballet, Dorothy and the Prince of Oz, this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. And Basil is doing set design and also doing some amazing puppetry. Now, you've just finished another production of ballet with Christopher Wheeldon at Joffrey Ballet of the Nutcracker.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of the things as a puppeteer you have to do is, like, you have to have your moments, but really it's about the dance first, and the puppets have to sort of be supporting. They can have their moments where everybody oohs and ahs, but
right.
But then they have to sort of, I would think they would have to move down a level for the dance. Or is this production really going to incorporate both equally?
Well, this production has more. When I work with Chris, in general, I've been more kind of doing what we sometimes call magical effects, which is not traditional puppetry like we think of, where there is something with a face and eyes and it's a dog or a swan or a person. I'm doing things like the Christmas tree. I've done a lot of trees with Chris. So, but they need to be magical and they need to have a sense of life to them, which is why it's appropriate that a puppeteer gets involved. And I'm calling upon frequently the dancers, the performers, to do something with the props. And they're more than props. I call them puppets, even though they may be tree branches, because it's a sense of bringing them to life. But this show is different, where there is still some of that thing. I always use silk in all my own work, and I'm sort of a silk whisperer, so I help other people use silk in their shows. But this show, there really are some traditional puppets. Some, you know, these dogs, the swan. There's another puppet character, and so that's really nice, you know. But it is true that puppets can be too strong at times. There are moments when people think, oh, wouldn't it be great if the puppet was still in the scene? And I say, no, you do not want the puppet in the scene, because it's as if a live animal walked on stage. You just cannot take your eyes off of it, you know. Even if the most incredible ballerina is doing the most amazing routine, if
there's somebody going to be watching the dog.
If a duck walked on stage, you just would look at it. You just would. And that actually happens with puppets. They're really, 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 really compelling. And so that's something frequently that I'm working with directors or choreographers who don't have that experience, is sometimes it is my job to say, I think we have to pull back here, because the puppet is, I don't want the puppet to overshadow stuff. It needs to either get off stage or get way to the side or be in the dark or be still, because it's not about the puppets. And the puppets are so unique and distinct and odd and quirky that they really do enchant people, and people get drawn into them in a very strong way.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. I know you come from a family of two generations of puppeteers. Your grandfather was a band leader in the big band era.
Yes.
And I'm still trying to get my head around it, but he would bring life-size puppets.
They weren't life-size. Oh. They were about half life-size. They're probably they're like 3 feet tall. And his name was Griff Williams. He was mostly a band leader. But the puppet thing was like a bonus thing that he threw in that he loved and that kind of distinguished him from other band leaders. But he had puppets of famous band leaders. So he had puppets of Harry James and Cab Calloway and Paul Whiteman and
Ted Lewis.
So
his band would be playing in the background and he would be...
And he would bring out one of the puppets and the band would play, you know, a typical Harry James number. And the trumpet player would play in the back, in sort of in the darkness, and then the Harry James puppet would play, and it would look like the puppet was playing. Wow. So I never met my grandfather. He died before I was born, but my grandmother Dorothy kept those puppets, and when I was a kid and I was already just puppet crazy, she gave them to me, and it sort of sealed the deal for me. So I still have those puppets.
Your mother also did puppets as well?
My mother did puppets for a while, although she was more of an amateur puppeteer. I mean, I grew up in San Francisco, and she was part of a small troupe of moms who were, you know, putting on puppet shows at hospitals and birthday parties. She doesn't do anything like that anymore. But it definitely had a big impact on me to be around puppets, to be around people doing puppet shows. And I mean, as long as I can remember, and even, you know, photos that I have of my childhood before I can remember, I have a puppet in my hand, or I'm at a puppet stage, or I was just nuts about them.
I think you said one time when you got to high school, it was like, you know, puppets were too close to dolls for a few years.
Yes.
What rekindled the love?
I just, once you actually get through high school and you're like, okay, what am I going to do now? Am I going to be a teacher, scientist, lawyer, doctor, fireman, what am I going to do? And nothing really, you're not sure. And then somehow you're reminded of what your passion was. And that happened, actually. I was going to school at Oberlin College in Ohio, and I wasn't very happy there. And I was there barely a semester before I... was sort of looking for an alternative. And I found, just on a whim, I found something about an internship program at the Center for Puppetry Arts in Atlanta, Georgia. And I just went, that's it. That's what I want to do. I remember that so vividly, that realization that, no, this is what I want to do. And I actually moved to New York first. I met Julie. Everything has then kind of unfolded so naturally from there. Eventually I went to France and went to school there, in a puppetry school.
Right.
So somehow when you get clear on what is, you know, what you really love and what you're passionate about, and you embrace that, I feel like that's a proof point. It just all falls in place.
Now, since then, you've done some incredible work, a version of Symphonie Fantastique done underwater.
Yes.
Underwater puppetry. I've seen short videos of this, and it's almost like abstract art.
That was the idea.
Visual abstract art.
That was the idea. It was actually, more importantly than that it was underwater, was that it was meant to be abstract. So mm-hmm. It was the idea of puppetry, but without really pulling it away from the sense of representation, and that the puppet had to look like something else. Like that you take cloth and plastic or wood and shape it to look like a swan or a dog or something. And instead, what if you just took the fabric itself and made it come alive? Just make it, it doesn't have a head or feet, or you can't tell if it, what it is, but you can tell that it's alive. And the way that abstract painting 100 years ago, and that was not that long ago, that people started to really do abstraction in painting, not having to paint a person or a bowl of fruit, but just doing colors and shapes. So I wanted to make a puppet show like that. And then I thought, well, I'll put it underwater.
Where did that underwater idea come from?
I don't know. I had seen something where I had seen a little a film of a small performance where they used a small fish tank. And I just thought it was really compelling. And there's just something about the water that actually it gives, you know, you could put a garbage bag underwater and it becomes magical. It has a life, the way that it moves, the way that it sort of twists and turns. You don't even need to touch it. You could just watch it. It's really fascinating. So that it was just another way to further abstract something and to sort of suspend things so that there was no gravity and that they could actually just move. And it was very lyric too, which was why it worked to accompany it to music. And that was the beginning of all this musical work I've done, which actually feeds right into the ballet and the, you know, work with dancers.
Yeah. Now, how big was your water tank? Because I've read that you had like three guys with the wetsuits on.
There were actually five of us.
Five of us.
And and the tank was 10 feet long and it was 1,000 gallons.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's not... And then, of course, you've done other amazing work, Dogu Gaishi,
yes.
Which is Japanese screens.
Yes.
In which it's just a matter of turning screens with the designs.
And... Yeah, I mean, all puppeteers really bow down to the Japanese. They have a very venerable tradition of puppetry in Japan. It's taken very seriously. And there, I was astounded to see that I thought that I was so cool with my abstract puppet show. And then I saw that there was actually a technique that had existed in Japan on one particular island that involved purely painted sliding screens, essentially an abstract show. It had, you know, no characters, no story. It was really a ballet and very pure movement because it was really mostly just lateral movement of screen doors opening. And it was an old tradition that had basically almost gone extinct. And I just thought that was so fascinating. So I was lucky enough to travel to Japan and actually try and find out more about it. And anyway, I created a show as homage to the technique, which is called Dogu Gaishi.
What's really interesting about your work is looking at your work, it has such a wide range. And there's no Basil Twist sort of look. I mean, you're mm-hmm. always recreating your look. I mean, your Hansel and Gretel perhaps paid a little more homage to Henson and the Muppets. Mm-hmm. You know, you have classic stick figures in one of the plays that you've done puppetry for.
Yeah.
It's just something different. Is that your sort of own personal challenge to come up with a completely different look every time?
I know that when I did Symphony Fantastique, and that was such an enormous response to that, and that was such a specific kind of volley that I put out there with this abstract underwater puppet show. And that show had a lot of success, so it led to an opportunity for me to do another show at Lincoln Center. So I had this great opportunity in a larger platform with more resources. And I said, well, now I want to do an old-fashioned show, which was Petrushka. So I did Petrushka, which was originally a ballet, and I did really rigorous, detailed, representative figures of the characters from the ballet, which is a clown and a ballerina, mm-hmm. and the blackamoor. They're classic ballet characters, and I wanted them to move extraordinarily and to do a really high-level technique of the highest level of puppetry that I could imagine, so that if I, as a puppeteer, was watching it, I would gasp. And I wanted to do that. And I wanted it to be different than the previous show. It was really kind of playing in opposition against myself. And I kind of kept doing that. Everything had to be different. If I do a small show, then the next show, it's exciting to do a big show. And when I do a really big show, then the next one, I want it to be a little show. I mean, at some point I do start repeating myself some. I do use fabric a lot in silk, and I do always include some element of abstraction in it. And I do find that I rely on some sort of Japanese, I'm sort of a Japanophile, mm-hmm. so that finds its way into my work. But no, thank you. I'm glad you observed that. I mean, I'm proud of my sort of the range that I've tried to put out there.
Well, you're finishing a big show now. Is it a small show next?
Well, the next thing I'm working on Broadway, on returning to Broadway. It's been a while, and I'm doing Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and I'm helping create the Oompa Loompas for that. So that's exciting. That's a big show, but it's not my show. I mean, I love my shows, the ones that are really I'm the author of, or I'm really the driving force behind, besides the collaborations. This is a collaboration. So my next show will be a small show. I'm not sure what it is, but it will be a smaller one, because the last big show of mine was The Rite of Spring, and it was big.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Well, Basil Twist, appreciate your time. We look forward to seeing the results on stage. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Puppeteer and MacArthur Genius Grant recipient Basil Twist speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's a part of the creative team for Tulsa Ballet's upcoming world premiere of Dorothy and the Prince of Oz, which takes place this weekend, first performance Friday evening at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. For details on the production, visit tulsaballet.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.